I thought your job was telling the truth.
Squish the executive, did we?
Well, maybe you should be telling it a little louder.
Louder! I can push, I can shove, I can scream, I can shout, but at the end of the day, I need Network 23, and I can't always say what I want!
Fine. Then if you can't, I will!
Not in my airtime.
As long as it's the truth, does it matter which of us tells it?
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. General election terror attacks. Well, we had three last time: Westminster Bridge, Manchester Arena, and London Bridge. So why do terrorists choose to do their dirty work during election campaigns, and are our authorities better prepared this time? Why did the Zionist lobby B'nai B'rith have to expel US members of their group in the early 1990s for actually advocating terrorist attacks against their own Israeli state? Plus, we go back to the history of war and terrorism in the young Israel between Zionist terrorists and the British Army. Also, vaccines. More information this week that 1990 Gulf War syndrome was caused not just by masses of immunizations given to soldiers before they flew out to fight in Kuwait and Iraq. Some of those vaccines had never been tested on humans before. Were the soldiers just guinea pigs? What are the implications for the scores of vaccines given to every newborn child today? Is there a profit motive behind compulsory mass vaccination? Why are so many mums trusting to natural immunity rather than injections? Are they being demonised as anti-vaxxers for just doing what they believe is best for their children? Are they really stupid? And the JFK assassination solved. But then the CIA tried to kill Grassy Knoll hitman James Files twice. We hear from him. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM, noon on Tuesday. This week, Grenfell Tower and the housing crisis. How come scores of blocks all across the country still have flammable cladding on them? Have the survivors been adequately housed yet? And what was Boris's role in the London Fire Brigade cuts then? BCFM's very own Roma Widger on the housing racket. Who's behind it? And what would it take for homes to cost to rent to buy roughly what they cost to build? You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or download that show right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But we start this week, Martin, with some amazing developments in Syria this week, with joint patrols in northern Syria between the Russians and the Turks. Now, Turkey's supposed to be in NATO. We got joint NATO-Russian patrols.
That's quite good news in my view, but there's also been fighting between the Turkish army and the Syrian army, in which there's been casualties and prisoners taken. So the situation is still very volatile. The US have obviously, you know, Trump going on about and they're leaving Syria, apart from keeping the oil field, and they're saying we're going to keep the oil and we'll decide what to do with that later. And of course, the so-called assassination of Baghdadi, Assad this week just basically poo-pooed it, said we don't believe a word they're saying about this. Don't forget that Baghdadi, if he was killed, was actually inside the Turkish military-controlled zone. And that's because, of course, the Turks all along have been supporting ISIS and Al-Qaeda, as have the Western powers.
Is there echoes of the death of bin Laden here, where everyone's sitting around in the Situation Room in the White House watching this, apparently,
well, I mean, of course,
live?
Trump gave the game away when he said he whimpered like a dog and all the rest of it, but of course he didn't have any sound. And of course the same as Simon Hirsch, the top US journalist, pointed out when bin Laden, because he's got very good contacts in the CIA and the military, and they basically tipped him off, this is all theatre.
So
that you cannot believe a word they say about these incidents. It's a political decision to create an incident where Baghdadi is killed so that Trump can take some kind of political profit from it because he's under he's under fire for supposedly Baghdadi, isn't he?
Because the United States had him actually in Abu Ghraib prison for at least a year, and then there is a disputed account as to whether maybe 3 or 4 years he was at another prison, and then he appeared around about 2009, 2010, 2011 as the leader of ISIS. This is bizarre, isn't it? Why would John McCain and the US state allow someone like that to just go free and start running around and start a terrorist group.
As you know, in Guantanamo Bay, which is still functioning, they've got two sections of it. One is called Penny Lane, and one is called what's the
Strawberry
one?
Fields.
Strawberry Fields. That's
Come on, it's the B side, isn't it?
Yeah. No, so you know what I'm talking about, because Strawberry Fields is forever, so they hold those people forever. But Penny Lane, they're turned and sent out.
You end up running a terrorist organization
with the wink, wink, nod, nod support of the CIA, MI6,
and the Saudis,
and the Israelis. That's right.
So the Saudis and the Israelis, really?
Yeah, yeah. The whole yes, of course. I mean, basically, we all know that the Saudis were supplying weaponry to ISIS. Bilal Erdogan was moving all of the oil out of where Des Azor is now. And it's only when the Russian Air Force came in and bombed the hell out of the tanker trucks that that ISIS started to crumble.
So were the Russians actually just kind of keeping an eye on these Turkish patrols?
What's happened is that Russians basically prefer diplomacy to war. They could, if they wanted to, go to war with Turkey, but they don't want to. And they'd rather do a deal with them. And, of course, Assad, they've got to talk to Assad about this. And, you know, we will do joint patrols to stop the Turks and the Kurds fighting each other. And we will try and do a deal. And I mean, ultimately, the Kurds now have basically said to the Syrian army, well, we're basically on the same side against the Turks. But the Syrians are saying, well, that's fine, but you've got to stop sort of, you know, you can't have all of this oil, which belongs to the whole of the Syria.
Well, actually, this is what I was about to come to, because Trump is now saying, oh, well, rather than bringing our boys home, some of our boys are going to be staying, hanging around the oil fields for a while because we actually quite like this
oil. Well, he actually said in his tweet, we're going to keep the oil and we'll decide what to do with it later, which is absolutely extraordinary. I mean, Barry McCaffrey, who's a retired US general, said, you can't say things like that. We've got no legal basis for and he's saying we could get ExxonMobil in there to develop the oil, the Syrian oil. And it's like, well, this isn't your oil. I mean, why do you think that you can put ExxonMobil in there to process it? And of course, nobody can really process it until there's peace, because the production has been smashed.
Is it really all about oil, or there are other agendas here?
No, no. I mean, the Americans are holding it. The Americans don't need that little bit of oil, but they just don't want anybody else to have it. Yeah. They don't want Assad to have it. They don't even really want the Kurds. Well, the Kurds basically can't have it, because although there is a Kurdish minority...
They're just denying it to others, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. That's the whole point. That's the whole point of US geostrategy, is to stop other people having oil.
In Libya too, it's this divide and ruin strategy.
Yeah, yeah.
So to basically destroy the country so that it's of no use to anyone else.
That's right. Well, 30,000 Chinese nationals were working in the Libyan oil industry, and they had to send ships to go and pick them all up and take them back to China. And of course, they'd spent millions of yen... developing the Libyan oil industry, and now it's all been captured.
So
who
ultimately is going to win these energy wars?
Well, this is a good question, isn't it?
The reason that there is an obsession with oil and energy generally is because you need a lot of it to fight a big war.
You do, and it's also, basically, if you can control energy, then you can control your enemies. And so the US interest in oil in the Middle East is not because they don't... Middle East oil doesn't generally go to the United States at all. But they want to control it so that they can deny it to the Chinese.
And the Syrians, for example.
The Syrians are small players. But yes, it's there. They've only got a small amount of oil, but they do need it. And the Americans are going to try and deny it to them. Ultimately, that could lead to a situation where the Syrian army goes in to take it back with Russian air support.
Well, the Russians...
they can do it. I mean, the Americans won't be able to defend that.
That's an interesting...
they're way away from their bases. The Iraqis are already saying, we don't want your US troops in Iraq. Take them out. Take them away.
Nord Stream 2 gets the go-ahead for Russian gas pipeline from, I believe it's Denmark. This Nord Stream 2 It's inching along. This week on the BBC, yesterday actually, Nord Stream 2 go-ahead for Russian gas pipeline angers Ukraine. Denmark has approved a controversial pipeline to pump more Russian gas into Europe. It strengthens Russians' influence in the region. And actually, the Germans want this too. So it's starting to sort of... The Russians, are they doing divide and rule amongst the European states here?
Well, I think that they would say that what we're trying to do here is be the adults in the room. If we develop relations where we're dependent on you and you're dependent on us, that makes it much less likely that we're going to do silly things like go to war with each other.
Well, US President Donald Trump said the pipeline owned by Russia's Gazprom could turn Germany into a hostage of Russia.
Well, what it does is it makes Germany less of a hostage of the United States. And that's why they don't like it. Because basically all these wars and so on that have been going on since 9/11, let's not go on, we could go on and talk about that. As Donald Trump said on the day, these buildings were bombed, they don't collapse like that. He was right about that. Basically, they haven't got anywhere. They're running out of road. They're not achieving their basic objectives.
The Danish permit was actually the last major hurdle for Nord Stream 2. The pipeline will run under the Baltic Sea from Russia to Germany, and it will then, by other pipelines, be able to spread around Europe, all this Russian
gas. Well, that's right. And, of course, it's a third of the price or two-thirds of the price of the alternative, which is American natural gas in ships. The terminals for which don't even exist yet. It's a no-brainer for German industrialists.
For James Bond in his submarine or whatever, it would be quite an easy pipeline to cut if someone.
Well, no, they're actually buried underground. I think that, you know, it's not just there. It's actually buried. You know, all pipelines are vulnerable. This is one of the problems. I mean, you know, FARC in Colombia used to be attacking pipelines continuously.
So, look, I mean,
you know,
one of the main questions here is why does it make Germany more dependent on the US? You can't get American gas over to Europe.
Well, no, but it makes them less dependent on the US. If they've got Russian gas, they can, when they're bullied by the Americans, you've got to join us to go to war in, I don't know, Iran. They can say, well, actually, we don't have to because we're not dependent on you.
Back to the fighting on the ground. CIA-backed Afghan troops committed war crimes. Report this week from the BBC. Afghan strike forces backed by the US Central Intelligence Agency committed abuses amounting to war crimes, according to a new report. Human Rights Watch alleges the troops committed summary executions and other grave abuses with no accountability, extrajudicial killings, forced disappearances and attacks on healthcare facilities. The Afghan government told the BBC the current situation was unacceptable. The CIA disputed the report, said its covert operations were carried out in accordance with the law and a robust system of oversight. Both the UN and the New York Times previously highlighted allegations of abuses by these Afghan strike teams. So who are these Afghan strike teams? One eyewitness says, I found my house was rubble. Two Afghan men from Maidan Warak province spoke to the BBC against US attacks on their homes. Who are these attacks?
Well, basically, this is a dirty war. The Americans have withdrawn.
Are these guys mercenaries?
They're local mercenaries, yeah? So what they're doing is they've Afghanized the war, or Ulsterization or Vietnamization, they used to call it. And of course, these guys are basically
They've got air support, these guys, because this guy is saying a bomb was dropped on his house. 12 members of his family, including his wife, 4 daughters and 3 sons, were killed when a huge bomb was dropped on his village. They martyred them all, he said. When I returned, I found my house was just rubble. Another man, Wadi Dullah, said troops broke into his home, dragged him and his family out. He said they took them to the top of a mountain where Americans gave them the order to carry out killings. So Human Rights Watch are saying this is not on.
Well, that's right.
But they can't do anything.
I mean, it doesn't at all surprise me that these things are going on. They've been going on in Afghanistan since the West decided to support the Mujahideen to get the Russians out, or not to get the Russians out. They started supporting the Mujahideen before the Russians came in, which is why the Russians came in. But in actual fact, of course, it's terribly sad. You know, Afghanistan has never had a chance to try and...
Well, you don't get sad, Martin, do you? You get angry about
Well, indeed,
like this.
Yeah.
I hope you do. So what can we do about something like this? Anything?
Well, we protest. I mean, ultimately, they've lost the war in Afghanistan. They've lost the war in Iraq. They've lost the war in Libya. They've lost the war in Syria. They lost the war in Vietnam 30 years ago. But they don't stop. They just carry on. And, of course, it's the local people in these poor countries that have to face the price.
So what we're talking about here is wars which are embarked on, which are, in the intelligence parlance, they call it a lose scenario. So they go in not even expecting to win.
Well, they don't need to win. But what they're doing is they're getting rid of good examples of things like Syria, for example, basically was a stable state that wasn't under their control, and they've now smashed it around. But of course, what's happened is that Syria's state has actually been strengthened by all of this. Syrian army must be one of the best outfits on the planet now after everything they've been going through, and they've taken horrendous casualties. I'd like to see the British army take hundreds of thousands of casualties and carry on fighting the way the Syrians
I don't
have.
Think there are hundreds of thousands of the British army. Anyway, new report now, not staying with all this stuff, 100,000 people have now been killed. It's topped the 100,000 mark in, guess what, in Yemen.
Yeah, but that's only the people killed in combat. The people who have been killed through starvation and breakdown of medical help aren't included in that figure.
Armed conflict location and event data project reports more than 20,000 deaths in 2019 alone. What is Yemen really all about?
Well, it's ultimately apparently, you know, it's all about geopolitics and controlling.
Well, why that part of the world?
Well, because look at where it is. It's
a former British colony.
Well, yes, that's right. And Yemen controls the outlet from the Red Sea. Or potentially can. And of course, it was a former British colony, and then we were kicked out. But of course, we then were involved in surreptitiously in all sorts of terrorist activity to overthrow the government of Yemen, you know, the Marxist government of South Yemen. And, you know, that doesn't, you know, Mark Curtis is very good about the history of British involvement in all of this. And of course, there are overt wars where people know what's going on. Oh, yes, the Americans are in Afghanistan. And there's all these other things that they're doing all over the world using proxies, including in Yemen when it was so-called independent. And of course, the Saudis have gone in there for their own reasons with support from the Americans and et cetera. Because, you know, they want to try and control the world, and that means you've got to, you know, that for all Yemen is in the way.
All of this is a big money churning machine at the Pentagon, spending
There's
on
money
this.
To be made from it all on the, as you kill.
And
that's
as
right.
We hear yesterday, US military spending bill over there failed in the Senate with a dispute over the border wall, a bunch of spending bills, including the US military Department of Labor, Health and Human Services, failed the Senate. Yesterday with a procedural vote that needed 60 votes, ending up 51-41, so it failed. This is all going to have to be punted until next year, so the military may not get the money they're after.
Well, they've got plenty of other ways to make... I mean, the CIA have been running the drugs trade in Latin America for years, so they've got plenty of slush funds to work with. The Senate in the US said that they should stop supplying Saudi Arabia to do what they're doing in Yemen, but Trump vetoed it. So that was the end of that.
Lebanon, there's been a lot of protests on the streets there. Yeah. This is very close to all the zones, well, particularly Syria and Israel we've been talking about.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Hariri resigned, which is very suspicious. And a lot of we've basically got several things going on at once. There's all these protests all over the world. But
well, some people are talking about a kind of Arab Spring, a new Arab Spring, maybe.
Well, this is happening all over the world, and it's very much young people in the front of it. But they've got different causes in each situation. And some people, like the people protesting against Evo Morales' election victory in Bolivia, they lost the election fair and square, but they're being supported by the Americans to go out and burn things down and throw rocks and stuff. And they're the good protesters. Whereas, of course, the Chilean protesters who are protesting against the right-wing government in Chile, they're bad protesters. You've got to understand there are good protesters, Tony, and there are bad protesters. When Hong Kong Chinese throw petrol bombs, they're fighting for freedom. When people in Belfast do it, they're terrorists. Okay.
And what about in Palestine when scores of people walk unarmed across particular boundaries, claiming a right to return?
Well, this week, an Israeli sniper got community service for shooting dead a 14-year-old unarmed Palestinian civilian. See, there is justice.
So, it's frustrating, isn't it, that one? But it's appropriate now. So one of the things we like to do on this programme is to try and put some of this into context. In other words, go back into history to understand, you know, how particularly the Middle East got where it is. It's a sort of pivot of international tension. And so this is a clip with Alison Weir from If Americans Knew. And here she talks about Zionist terrorists in 1946, literally just at the cusp of the foundation of the Israeli state. At the time, Martin, there was a war going on, really, between Zionist terrorists, people like the Stern Gang, and the British Army.
And, of course, the Jabotinskyite right-wing terrorists in Israel had actually approached the Nazis to say, we will fight the British for you if you give us Palestine. They didn't get anywhere with it, but they definitely made the approach.
So,
and, of course, they modelled their movement on Mussolini's movement.
From If Americans Knew, here's now Alison Weir.
As the violence increased, there were some terrorist organizations created in Palestine by the Zionists. One of them led by a former, in fact, two of them led by future Israeli prime ministers. And those terrorist organizations in Palestine, the Irgun and the Stern Gang, it turns out, had front groups in the United States with duplicitous names. And they were funneling massive amounts of money and weaponry to these terror groups in Palestine. They put on major pageants where Supreme Court justices attended and thousands of people attended. They were very prominent. One of them was led by a man named Peter Bergson, people thought. His real name was Hillel Cook. He was the operative for the Irgun. I looked into one of the leaders a bit more, just because I needed to find out his first name. When you're writing a book, you can't just write someone's last name. You need to know their first name. And I had heard about another leader of one of these types of front groups connected to killing in Palestine. And his name was Rabbi Korf, but I didn't know the first name. None of the books that I had a few paragraphs of them, but none of them gave his first name. So I looked into it on the internet, tried to do various searches, and eventually I came up with a UN report that gave his first name, Baruch Korf, and told a little bit about a plot he was part of. Using those search terms, I then could put in more information into my search bar, and suddenly all these PDFs of American newspapers popped up, all of these returns. It turned out that Rabbi Baruch Korf was part of a cell in Paris that was planning to fly an airplane and bomb Britain after the war. Britain that had just defeated Hitler. But they were so angry at the British because the British were not allowing a large enough Jewish immigration into Palestine. So they were going to kill the British. So Baruch Korf and his section of the Stern Gang had this plan, but there was one problem. They didn't know how to fly an airplane. They weren't pilots. So they needed to find somebody, and they recruited a young American aviator named Reginald Gilbert, I discovered. Reginald Gilbert had been an ace during the war. He was in Paris, and they recruited him to fly the airplane for them. He pretended to go along with the plot, but then he went to the American Embassy. And the American Embassy informed the Paris police and Scotland Yard. So for a week, he pretended to go along with this cell. And then when it came time to actually take off, to fly the plane, to drop these incendiary bombs onto the foreign ministry, they were caught. By the way, the original plan had been to bomb Parliament, but then they decided they hated the foreign ministry more. And Gilbert at one point had said to them, well, what if I can't find the foreign ministry in the London fog? They didn't have this degree of instrumentation we have today, and that was a real possibility. And they said, then just drop them anywhere. Kill anybody. All British are our enemy. So they were caught. Korf was in prison for a few months in Paris, and he eventually got off. He had very powerful friends in the United States. But I was curious about him. I looked into him some more. This was so astounding to me. And none of these, dozens and dozens of books I have, none of them had this story in there at all. And so in looking at him, I discovered that later in life, he was a friend of Richard Nixon. In fact, it was reported that he had helped to influence Nixon's policies on the Middle East. In fact, Nixon, sort of in a fond way, called him my rabbi. Now, the precursor to today's very powerful Israel lobby was a group called the American Zionist Emergency Council, AZEC. This was formed in around 1940, and by 1943 had a budget of $500,000 at a time when a nickel bought a loaf of bread. Within a few years, they had maneuvered their way into access to an even far larger sum, in which they had access to $14 million in 1941 and $150 million by 1948. That's the equivalent in today's dollars of $1 trillion to use to manipulate the United States.
Well, I didn't know about that particular incident, but it shows that, you know, the state of Israel was created by Class A terrorists
and money for terrorism and also for lobbying at the same time.
Yeah, well, what happens is that every Israeli citizen is in receipt of tens of thousands of dollars worth of subsidy every year from the US taxpayer. I mean, basically, there's
they don't get the money themselves.
No, it goes to the US. It goes to the Israeli state, which then spends it on weaponry and all sorts of other things. And of course, one of the things they spend it on,
Martin, is healthcare too, I imagine.
Well, yes. In other words, they have quite a nice lifestyle at the expense of the US taxpayer, and they've also got money to spare, as we found out from that Al Jazeera sting, to spend £1 million getting the Labour Party to do what they want. And I noticed that the Jewish Labour Movement, which is basically a front for the Israeli embassy here, have come out strongly this week saying that they can't possibly support the Labour Party in the coming election because Jeremy Corbyn's an anti-Semite, blah, blah, blah. And of course, they're in receipt of funds from the Israeli embassy, I suspect, and those funds ultimately come from the US taxpayer. And of course, if you've got free money, why don't you can spend it, can't you?
Well, Anton Chaitkin, we have on this programme fairly often, he's not very well at the moment in the US, but one of his talks, he explained that B'nai B'rith, a Zionist lobby group in the US, was actually advocating false flags. This is 1994-ish, false flag attacks on Israel in order to advance the Zionist cause there, because they felt that the Palestinians were doing too well.
Well, the whole concept of false flag attacks has finally become into the mainstream. But of course, the Mossad's slogan is "through deception to make war." And they've been engaged in these kind of false flag attacks for years. Viktor Ostrovsky was a former Mossad agent. He exposed what happened when Libya was bombed by Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. They basically planted a bomb in a discotheque in Berlin, which killed a US service person. And then they planted a radio transmission from Libya saying, "Why don't you plant a bomb?" which was all done by the Israelis. And so the Libyans were then put in the frame for planting the bomb. And then immediately Britain attacked Libya, killing Gaddafi's daughter and 100 other people. And of course, what happened at the time, the French wouldn't let British and US planes use their airspace. They had to fly around via Gibraltar. But of course, the whole point about this is the bomb was originally, which killed a US service person, was actually planted by the Israelis.
The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in a bit of a sticky wicket at the moment. He's not really quite sure whether he's going to be prosecuted or whether he's going to be remade as the Prime Minister. But his first outing as Prime Minister was in 1996. He won the elections there, Martin. Just before he did, there were a whole spate of bomb attacks actually in Israel itself, weren't they, on public transport, buses and that sort of thing.
Yep, and don't forget that Hamas was originally set up by the Israeli intelligence services to undermine the Palestine Liberation Organization. Now, it's become an independent of the Israelis since then, but originally it was set up because they wanted to encourage more extreme Islamist tendencies within the Palestinian population as a way of kind of delegitimizing nationalist resistance to Israeli rule. And they've been playing this kind of game all along. I mean, because they're a small state, you know, the size of Wales and all the rest of it, you've got to be very tricky, like the Venetians used to be in the past, because they had a very small state.
So we're talking about medieval times.
Yeah, medieval times and into early modern times.
As a city state.
Yes, so basically they used to play all sorts of tricksy games, get other people to fight each other, you know, divide and rule and all the rest of it.
Can I say, not entirely unlike Bristol. We were effectively a sort of city-state here, weren't we?
Yeah, indeed. But I mean, let's not mix things up. I mean, the point I'm trying to make is, if you're a small player, then the Lavon affair, which was exposed in the 1950s, loads of bombs went off in Egypt, supposedly carried out by Islamist militants attacking British and other targets. And then the Egyptian police caught those concerned, and it turned out they were all Israelis pretending to be Islamists. And this is all on the record, and that's been the tactics of the Israeli state from the get-go.
Okay, so you know where I'm coming round to talking about here, and that is our general election. And the last general election in 2017, there were three, in the run-up to it, attacks, weren't there? Westminster, London Bridge, and the Manchester Arena bombing. Why do you think the terrorists choose these times to make their bombs?
Because in actual fact, the terrorism that is being orchestrated from inside our intelligence structure,
Well, hang on, because maybe it's just something that maybe the intelligence services just don't have the manpower to be everywhere all the time.
Well, I mean, let's look at the Manchester bomb, which is probably the most serious incident. The boy who was eventually framed for that, or did it or didn't do it or whatever, was part of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group. Now, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group are an Al-Qaeda group.
Hang on, blew himself up in there.
He blew himself up, but we don't know whether...
Salman Abedi.
Yeah, well, all right, but the point
is... And there was CCTV released of him, though there was actually no context, so it was all blacked out.
Well, indeed. But the main point I would make about this is that he was part of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group had been integrally working with Western intelligence services, including British intelligence services, going back to the 1960s, as a way to undermine Gaddafi. And that was, of course, what Dave Shaler and Annie Masham were saying years ago.
You're talking about the guy that thinks he's Jesus?
I'm talking about Annie Masham, if you prefer, who used to work for MI5. The fact is that they discovered that MI6 were planning a bomb attack inside Libya. There was a bomb attack inside Libya that killed several people. It didn't get Gaddafi. And who carried out that bomb attack? The Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, who are basically allied with the Western intelligence services. So when this guy blows himself up in the Manchester arena, it's either blowback. Why did you arm these people in the first place? Because somebody obviously knew how to build a proper bomb there. How did they learn how to do that? Somebody must have taught them, probably the SAS. And of course,
why would the SAS make bombs to blow up Manchester?
Well, because the intelligence services are integrated into these Islamist groups. It's been quite clear what's been going on in Syria. The Syrian army are very well aware of it. The Russian army are very well aware. British military personnel are in there, openly or covertly, helping to the jihadis with their Saudi allies to try and overthrow the Assad regime. It's exactly what happened in Pakistan and Afghanistan in the 1980s. Who trained Al-Qaeda to use bombs? We did, and we provided them with the weaponry as well, and we've been doing that all along.
The other thing about Salman Abedi, just like the attackers at Westminster Bridge and London Bridge, had actually been reported to the MI5 anti-terror hotline. Had said this guy's a nutter keeper.
So in actual fact, there's two sorts of things happens with false flag attacks, Tony, as you know. There's what they call lie hop and my hop. Let it happen on purpose and made it happen on purpose. Some things are basically not at all what they seem, and it's not the people who are doing it, somebody else has done it. But sometimes what you do is you just cultivate people and let them do it. You could stop them, but you don't. If you think about the three attacks in the last election campaign, they turned it on to Corbyn and said, Corbyn's the sort of person who's soft on terrorism, and that's why you have terrorism. We've got to be very vigilant as we go into this election campaign that we don't get a similar result.
The leader of the London Bridge attack had actually been on a Channel 4 programme called something like The Jihadis Next Door, and he was being interviewed saying, well, actually, I think, I've got a lot of sympathy for ISIS and all this sort of thing. How come, surely, you can't just arrest someone for saying that, can you?
No, but at the same time, but they've also, what's come out in this report is that MI5 stopped surveying him a couple of weeks before he carried out the attack, even though they had been surveying him. Now, that shows you what can happen.
So I wonder
actually carry out an attack, we decide not to look at him anymore.
I wonder whether the officer involved has been disciplined or even interviewed, maybe, by the police.
Well, indeed, that's what nearly needs to happen. That's what happened in Italy in the 70s and the 80s. The police started interviewing intelligence officers because they eventually worked out that what was the Bologna bomb, the bomb at Piazza Fontana in 1969, the kidnap of Aldo Moro, all carried out from inside NATO intelligence services, as the Italian police are very well aware. But of course, does Boris Johnson know what we're talking about? I don't suppose he does he?
Well, a lot of the reason for us being here is because a lot of the mainstream press doesn't really critique much of this, Martin, does it? It seems to just take whatever the Home Office say or the security services, which is the Home Office. In fact, we even had Charles Shoebridge on this programme, a former army officer and special branch officer, saying that actually the main home affairs correspondents for the London media are the press officers for MI5.
Well, that's right. I mean, of course, if you're going to carry out these false flag attacks, you also have to control the narrative afterwards so that you can blame the right people. Oh, we've got to invade Afghanistan. Oh, we've got to go to attack Libya. And as I mentioned earlier, Donald Trump, who's not really an insider, said on the day that there must have been bombs in the three towers that went down on 9/11, because they don't collapse like that from fires. And then, of course, that's all on the record. And out of the mouths of babes and sucklings, eh?
The control of the media is one of the regular themes on this programme, and particularly for the narrative of events, as Martin was just saying. And there was a fascinating thing by Emily Bell. I think it was on Radio 4. She's from somewhere called the Tau Center for Digital Media in New York. And she's explaining how modern governments use social media and the mass media to control the narrative. Now, this isn't specifically about terrorism, but they're saying that, well, the media are always desperate for somebody to come on. And so that the people who are in power make sure that they come across in a way that doesn't allow any kind of interrogation exactly the way they want. So here's Emily Bell here from the Center for Digital Media in New York.
The Modi model, what does it tell us about how the relationship between politicians and the media has changed?
It's a great place to start in India, because what we're really seeing is our role as journalists, as intermediaries, declining, and the social platforms and, if you like, the straight-to-consumer model rising.
Which is very frustrating, of course, because our job as journalists is to hold power to account. The idea that power can simply talk directly to people without being questioned feels very difficult.
That's right, and I think that Modi is extraordinary in that he had his entire first term as Prime Minister without a single press conference. And yet, every day he was on social media, his activists and party members are all over WhatsApp spreading his word. He is somebody who will talk to compliant journalists. And that's actually a model which I think we're going to repeat as we see the rise, if you like, of these authoritarian personality-led models in global politics.
Indeed.
And global media. Well, that's an interesting take on it, isn't it? We like to think of social media as being liberating, but what they're saying is social media allows these powerful characters like President Modi in India just simply to say what he wants and have no questions asked at all.
That's right. And the only defence against that is that there's a plethora of voices out there, and if you listen, say, to us, you're going to get a different version. And but you can see that the mechanisms of control, I mean, in 1984, people knew that the television was watching them. So, you know, they used to hide round the corner. Winston Smith hid round the corner when he didn't want them to be watching him. But people go out and buy top of the range smartphones, which basically spy on every move they make. And they even pay money for it and think that they're being liberated by buying them. So this is, you know, how are we going to manage this new world order, as it were? Well, I mean, basically the responsibility to find out what's going on lies ultimately with the individual.
Well, there was a BBC,
you've got to make the effort.
A BBC programme as well recently on Radio 4 called Impartial Journalism in a Polarised World, one of those quite irritating titles that doesn't necessarily really mean much, but it had the ITV's Robert Peston on it saying what he thinks about social media and the influence that that's having on journalism today.
I think we've got to be really, really careful here. It is not the case, James, that we have newspapers that are very tightly regulated other than for libel and for treating people in a sort of vicious way in terms of invasion of privacy. But politically, they can do what they like. If they want to put tendentious nonsense on their front pages, they can. And actually, if it weren't for the counterweight of people being able to put out an alternative message on the internet, actually, I think people would be much worse served, arguably.
Yes,
I mean, for better or worse, whether or not you think it was a good thing or a bad thing that Theresa May's 2017 election led to, you know, almost a hung Parliament and contributed to that Labour surge would not have happened without the ability of Jeremy Corbyn to go direct to people over the internet. And many people would say that was good for freedom, not bad for freedom, because the vast majority of newspapers were vicious about him day after day, many, quite often in a genuinely unfair way. My own view, just very briefly on this, and I think we can go back to the 1930s to get a bit of a lesson here about what we might be able to do. The 1930s were arguably way more polarised in terms of political opinion than where we are now. We had the threat of both communism and Nazism. One of the things that government did at that point was to invest in, you know, the state impartial broadcaster and gave it the appropriate resources. And I would argue that the best thing that any government can do at the moment is make sure that the guardians of impartiality in TV, in radio, have the resources they need to at least be a loud voice against some of the nonsense that is out there, a corrective.
I suppose what we're hearing from this discussion is that it's important that all these different voices are out there. Often, though, Martin, people say, well, a particular view is offensive, and then they will try and actually shut that view down for whatever reason because of that's their view.
Well, I think if I was to, I can say all sorts of things to you, Tony, on air. And as you know, BCFM, we're regulated by Ofcom and we can't swear and so on. But you shouldn't be able to do anything online that you couldn't do to somebody's face. You can't threaten to kill people. That's illegal. Yeah. And I can't see there should be any problem with people not being allowed to go around threatening people. But apart from that, people should be allowed to say what they like. As long as people don't cry for their mummies, when if you're going to say all Muslims should be, as Rod Liddell did this week, that Muslims shouldn't be allowed to vote in this country, I think I'm allowed to call him a fascist, aren't I?
General election 2019, government accused over political Facebook ads. This is, I suppose, the logical progression of all this control now that social media has. Government's accused of putting public funds to target voters in key general election seats with Facebook ads. The ads say the government is investing up to £25 million in the town where the message appears on Facebook feeds.
Yes, I mean, that's already been picked up by various Labour MPs. What's happened up in Kingswood is that the local council there, which is run by the Tories, have been putting out council propaganda, which is paid for by the council, which is basically Tory party.
Okay.
Tory party propaganda.
Getting back to this terrorism thread we were talking about and elections, do you think it's likely there might be a terrorist attack during this 2019
we've
general
got to
election
be, we've got to be we've got to be vigilant. And of course, what we do if something does happen, we need to ask questions about what happened and why. I think it's not an accident that these things turn up during elections. The Italian police realised this years ago, and Posimato used to head up the Italian Supreme Court, who wrote his famous book La Repubblica dei Stragi Impuni, The Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, which came out in 2012. The only way to deter the deep state operatives who do these things is to make sure that they realise that if you do any of this stuff, we're going to be all over it, and we're going to look into every aspect of it, and we're
If something does happen, what should we do? How do we know what's happened?
Well, as you know, Tony, years ago, the first thing you should do is, if something's happening, switch on your recording button on your TV or your computer or whatever, because what usually happens is there's loads of evidence comes out immediately with all of these attacks, and eyewitnesses say things are completely different what the story then subsequently becomes. So you need to get as much evidence as you possibly can. As you know, our friend Adrian did that on 7/7. He sat down as soon as the bombs went out, and he sat down for 2 weeks and downloaded everything about it, everything that everybody had said, and soon it became clear the official story didn't add up.
I noticed, for example, some of the BBC correspondents, people like that, deleted tweets in the Westminster attack. They'd said there was a second killer or something in the area,
often,
and those tweets then got deleted.
Involved. So you could always suspect the lone killer.
I mean, it did look as if that was
narrative.
That was a false alarm, or else possibly even deliberate in order to get people deliberate to get people out of the area, so that the actual zone of what was happening when the Westminster attack could be completely controlled.
Well, that's right. And what they claimed, this is Westminster, by the way, that all of the CCTV footage of the attack, there wasn't any, because of budget cuts, the CCTV wasn't on outside Parliament. We're expected to believe that, you know.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, a lot of this problem started with the assassination of John F. Kennedy. That was in November back in 1963. And so I thought we'd have a listen now to the guy that did it. I mean, I think it's pretty conclusive. The evidence is there for people that want to see it. Quite a lot of people don't want to see it. But he was a hitman from Chicago, Martin. His name is James Files. And it is quite known that the Chicago Mafia were pretty annoyed with Kennedy, weren't they?
That's right. I mean, it's basically the usual suspects, if you like. It's the Mafia. the CIA and the far right inside the military that are carrying out most of this stuff.
And what I'll do is I'll put a link up on our show page for the full interview with James Files. It's a fascinating, like, 2.5 hours. I was listening to it in the car when I was on holiday a couple of months ago, just as I'm driving around. You think, no, crikey. And it's a fascinating insight. And he's now in jail somewhere in the US. We're going to be hearing from him in a minute about the two attempts to kill him after the assassination, apparently by the CIA. But here's what he says he was doing up on the grassy knoll in November 1963.
And at that point, when they started proceeding down Elm Street, shots started being fired from behind, and I assumed that it was Mr. Nicoletti because he is the one who was in the building, and I knew that Johnny Roselli was there. I remember the shots ringing out, and even though the president was being hit with the rounds, I was considering it a miss because I knew that we were going for a headshot on the president. And I had known he had been hit in the body, but I didn't know what part at that time. And I seen the body lurch, and I saw the body lurch again. I heard another shot that missed, and we were supposed to hit no one but Mr. Kennedy. And I guess Governor Cumley got hit with one of the rounds at that point. And I wasn't even sure of that because I was keeping Kennedy as best I could in the scope on the fireball. And when I got to the point where I thought it would be the last field of fire, I had zeroed in to the left side of the head there that I had, because if I waited any longer, then Jacqueline Kennedy would have been in the line of fire, and I had been instructed for nothing to happen to her. At that moment, I figured this is my last chance for a shot, and he still had not been hit in the head. So as I fired that round, Mr. Nicoletti and I had fired approximately at the same time as the hit started forward, then it went backward. I would have to say that his shell struck approximately 1/1000th of a second ahead of mine, maybe. That's what started pushing the head forward, which caused me to miss in the left eye, and I came in on the left side of the temple. At that point, through the scope, I witnessed everything, matter and skull, being blown out to the back of the limousine, and everyone on television watching saw Jackie Kennedy crawl out there to get it. I watched her hold on her hand to crawl back in the car, and I put the fireball back into the briefcase and closed it up, and I'd pull my jacket off, reverse my jacket, so I would have, instead of a plaid side out, I would have the gray like a dress jacket, more or less, and I put a cap on my head, my hat, to walk away with carrying a briefcase.
Lyndon called me from the Texas Hotel, and he was still irate. I said, Lyndon, about last night, and he went to cursing. He used foul language all the time, and he said, those Kennedys, he repeated, they will never embarrass me again. That's no threat. That's a promise. And I'd like the entire world to know how I personally feel is the fact Lyndon Johnson knew about the assassination and was a part of it.
I'm in prison for a specific reason. When I come out of the federal prison, I did a federal stretch and I was out for a little while. People started trying to kill me. When they started trying to kill me the first time, I was at along Quentin Road and Rollins Road in Round Lake Beach, shortly past midnight, driving a little Chevy Chevette. And the cops had been harassing me there. They knew who I was. Every time they see me, they'd handcuff me, get me out of the car, my papers blow out, they'd throw all my stuff down the street. So this particular night, I pull up the stoplight there. I'm on Quentin Road, fixing to make a right-hand turn on Rollins Road. I'm staying with my aunt and uncle at this time. They're about 2 blocks down from there. I looked up in the rearview mirror, and I seen a car pulling up behind me with no lights in the next lane. And I thought, shit, it's cops again. You know, I'm going to get hassled again. It's not a squad car number, but I just figured it's detectives, you know. As it pulls up alongside of me, I'm looking in the mirror sitting by the door, the little door mirror on the side. And I see an SMG come up. What anybody don't know that is, it's a small machine gun, automatic weapon. As I see it coming out of the window, I roll across the seat, hit the door, hit the ground, roll back up against the rocker panel of the car. They put 30 holes in my car. Full clip they put into it. As they were pulling away, I come up off the ground with my piece, and I got up about 4 rounds. I'm on federal parole at that point. I'm not supposed to be carrying a weapon, but you never find me without a weapon. I got off 4 rounds, took the back window out. They kept going. I jumped back in my car, took a right on the Rollins Road, went down to Grove Avenue, pulled into the house at my aunt and uncle's at 1620 Grove, went in there and got the tarp from my uncle out of the garage and put it over the car so they couldn't see the bullet holes. That was the first attempt on my life.
When was that?
I got out of federal prison in 88. This year's late 89, early 90, I guess.
Been any attempts on your life in prison?
Not in prison. I've had a lot of fights, but that's not attempts on my life. I mean, the things that happen here is... It's just day-to-day living. I got a few scars and knives here and there, but that's irrelevant there.
You don't think it was people trying to take you out?
Oh, no. Definitely not.
Well, then certainly wouldn't have anything to do with the JFK job.
No, definitely not. And when they started trying to kill me on the street, that was the first attempt on my life in the free world, as I call it. Next day, I went to see somebody down in the city, and I went up and I asked him a specific question. If we had a problem, I said, I went and I did my federal time. I said, I got busted on the chop shops. I didn't take nobody down with me. I said, I went, kept my mouth shut. I didn't testify. I didn't give nobody up. I took the conviction. I done my time. What's the problem? We got a problem. Let me know. And he told me, he said, Jimmy, he says, he always called me Jimmy. He said, Jimmy boy, he says, come down, come down. He said, listen to me. He said, you got no problem with us. He said, you did your thing. He said, hey, you didn't have the problem when you was down. You got money, looked after certain people for you, took care of your family. You had no problems. When you come out, you went to the restaurant. He said, everybody parked. Everybody come by to see you. He said, we dropped a lot of envelopes. He said, you have money when you come out. Everybody looked after you when you come out. That's respect. Said, don't think we're after you. Said, whatever you've done, it's for your previous employers, not us. That's on the other side of the fence, the people that you worked for before. He said, them, not us, Jimmy. He said, I give you my word on that. The second attempt, I was on my motorcycle, and it's a long story. I won't go through all that.
Hold a minute. So okay. You're saying that attempt was not the mob. That was the agency.
That was the agency. That was the government. Somebody in the government.
So
I
the
believe
government has tried to take you out.
That's what I honestly believe.
Okay, make a statement.
Now then, the second time on my attempt, are you talking about making a statement with the government?
Yeah.
After I talked to the certain parties in Chicago down in the city about them trying to kill me, and he's telling me that was my previous employers. What we're talking about here, we're talking about a government agency. I won't say which agency it was that tried to take me out, but I know at that time I was had people in the DOD on me because I had taken certain material off the computer at Oxford from the arsenal, so that I worked in the office. I had an excess classified material there for building new tanks, new helicopters, everything. I had the gun emplacements off one of the Black Hawk helicopters. I had the allocations for everything. I had the rate of firing, anything that's classified, because we made a lot of the stuff there. We made the nitrine cable to fire the Sidewinder missile inside a federal prison. Okay. Anyway, the second attempt was, well, now I realize this here is not the crime family after me. It's got to be a government agency. The second attempt on my life was, late at night, they ran me over on my motorcycle. They hit me so hard, they bent the frame on it. They totaled the motorcycle out. That's all on record. Next time I come around, the third time, with these two off-duty officers. One of them is David Ostertag. They will never admit they had a contract on my life, and I want to say one thing. I got no hard feelings against either one of these officers, even though they tried to kill me. I don't take this anything personal. I take it they were doing a job. They were doing what they was paid to do. They just blew it. But the thing is this. I'm here because somebody opened up on my partner and me. They tried to kill us in broad daylight on May 7th, 1991, 3:15 p.m., maybe 3:30, in the middle of Route 12 in a little place called Buffalo Grove. We're between Quentin Road and Long Grove Road on Route 12. They forced us off the road. When they forced us off the road, they say it was a high-speed chase. It really wasn't a high-speed chase. They spotted me at a gas station. I didn't even see them. I paid for the gas, got in the car. My partner, David Morley, he was driving. As we pulled out from there, they got in behind us. And they got up alongside of us. He started hit the gas to go. And I told him, now hold it, pull it over. We don't run from nobody. We don't run. Pull it over. We'll deal with it. They cut us off like he pulled into like a part of a driveway. It was gravel, a little fast. He hit the brakes. We slid into a little tree. The tree we hit wasn't any bigger than my arm. I threw the door open on the right-hand side to exit the car. This was the leased car. As I threw the door open to exit, they drove their car, which is a white unmarked car, into the side of our car. When I seen the front of the car coming at the door, I jerked my leg back up off the ground so I wouldn't get it cut off and they were broken. And dug my head, and when they hit the door hit me and knocked me back into the car. I bounced off the dash, and at that point, they opened fire. My partner, David Morley, very good man. He saved my life on several occasions in the free world. His left hand is paralyzed. He'd been shot up a couple times before in shootouts. He can't use his left hand. At this point, he's leaning down, fumbling under the seat of the car, looking for his gun, looking for a 9mm. And I'm yelling, get out, get out, get out. And to me, it seemed like it's taking forever. When he got the 9, he put it up under his arm. He's got to close his arm, reach across, open the door to exit. Well, this is only a few seconds, but it seemed like a lifetime to me. We come out of the car. When he come out, he took the first shot. David Ostertag went down. At this point, when I come out, there was no need for me to even shoot. The other officer, Bittner, I didn't know they were cops at that time. Neither did my partner. We had no idea they were police officers. He crawled up under the car. And he was saying, they're going to kill us both. They're going to kill us both. But David Ostertag was already down. I grabbed the AK-47 out of the car, had it in the back seat. I'd went and picked that up out of the storage shed for the simple reason I'd had a meeting prior to those people, and somebody had poked me in the chest, and I just knocked them down and stomped on them a couple times and told them, don't ever threaten me to tell me you're going to trunk me. If you do, do it first and then come and tell me that you done it. I went and told Dave, I said, we got problems. I went and got the AK-47 out, got the ammo can out. I had a 30-round clip in the AK-47. This is all in the law books. The ammo can had 520 rounds of ammo in it. David Ostertag can tell you how many rounds we had for the 9mm, the clips, all the loose rounds. I went into a little swamp. Took them several hours to get me out. The AK-47 tractor spring had broke. It wouldn't fire.
Any witnesses to all of this?
A lot of people around. A lot of people. We had traffic backed up from the shooting incident there all the way to Wisconsin and all the way to the city of Chicago.
So if they who opened fire first?
They opened fire first.
And they were in an unmarked car.
Unmarked car.
Plain clothes?
Plain clothes. They had a windbreaker on. They were wearing a badge on their gun belt underneath the windbreaker jacket sitting in a car. They were shooting from inside the car. David Ostertag had exited coming around shooting when David Morley dropped him.
Did they ever say you were under arrest or?
No.
Did they identify, did they yell police officer?
Nobody identified nothing. I mean, the shooting started.
How many shots were fired before Joe Parker took the shot?
Well, I'm going to say they got off probably the first 14 shots. They say they fired 3 and 11 out of 52. They said we fired the rest of them. But there's not that many shell cases on hand. And if the only weapons that were fired were 9 millimeters that day, and my weapon hadn't been fired, that leaves 3 clips. It's only 45 rounds of 15 rounds to 9 millimeter in a staggered clip. And they didn't fire that many. They still had rounds in theirs. So there's no way 52 rounds were fired that day. Oh, there's all kind of witnesses that seen what went down. There's witnesses that will plainly state on who got out and who shot who and who shot first. That's all in the court documents.
So how did they get a conviction if there were witnesses to say they fired first?
That was very simple. We were tried in Lake County, Illinois. It didn't take them long to convict us. Everybody on the jury was related to a cop. You don't shoot a cop and walk away. You shoot a cop, it don't matter if it's self-defense or not.
Were the witness reports allowed as evidence?
Some of those were denied. I had witnesses that come there to testify on my behalf, and that was irrelevant, and they were not permitted to testify. My own aunt was not permitted to testify at my trial. As far as I'm concerned, it was a frame-up. It was self-defense, over and out. And I didn't even shoot nobody.
So that's James Files there, Martin. Quite an amazing story. And I suppose it's amazing that he's still alive. He was trained as a gunman, a sniper in the 82nd Airborne Division. So he'd been in combat in Korea. And he was always, he says there, a Chicago mafia hitman, always carried a gun, even if he was on parole or something at the time.
Well, I mean, obviously, it's a kind of a dramatic story, but the most important part of it is he was the guy who actually pulled the trigger that killed John F. Kennedy from the grassy knoll, which, of course, we didn't get in that particular... but, of course, what happens if you get involved in that stuff is you then become a liability. And, of course, as we all know, Lee Harvey Oswald didn't get to testify about anything because Jack Ruby killed him, and then Jack Ruby himself got killed because that's the sort of thing that happened.
So it's quite hazardous occupation taking on this role of killing a politician, because the people who put you up to it, he was there implying the CIA put him up to it. And his local mafia was saying, well, it's nothing to do with us. If someone's trying to kill you, it's not us, it's the agency.
Yeah. I mean, and Sirhan, who supposedly killed Robert Kennedy, I mean, Robert Kennedy's son is says that he's found other people who are involved. And, you know, the assassination of Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, I mean, you'd have to be living on Mars not to realise that the state was involved in all of that. In Martin Luther King's case, there's been a civil court case where the jury basically came to the conclusion that he was assassinated by the FBI, and that James Earl Ray was nothing to do with it.
So what has been the knock-on effect today for the Kennedy assassination in a nutshell? Because it has affected
the
world massively.
What I would say about this is people who say politicians are all the same and you can't trust them, they all lie. Why did they try and assassinate some of them and not others?
Okay, time to sign off now for the US Home Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. That's Tony Carey, Lib Dem councillor.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2.
I'll be on this show's podcast,
and on your
story
mobile
links and comment page. this week, oneword.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Dialects next Tuesday at noon. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.